I started out working as a parish pastor to become acquainted with a church. Worked in a what would probably be considered a poor working class barrio in Bogota, the capital of Colombia. I worked there for 3 years. And then at the end of those 3 years, the church named me National Youth Coordinator. So I tried to put together a youth program for the whole Colombian Lutheran Church, which isn't a very big church. It's only about 1,200 people in 10 congregations and 3 mission stations around the country. What I'd like to do this afternoon, since I think some of you are already well aware of what liberation theology is, or at least you have some notions, I'd like to try and contextualize the situation just a little. Say some things about the kind of life a person leads in Latin America, and then say just a few things about liberation theology. Give you just a brief introduction to it for those of you who don't know about it. And then later on we can talk about some of the implications that this theology has for us as North American Christians. As usual, as everyone has been trying to do, starting with Dan Erlander, I guess, a week or so ago, I first heard it. I'm going to try to get you to think in a whole new set of categories and imagine yourself in a situation very different from the one which you are living in and have lived in. So let's suppose that at the end of your stay in Holden, whether you're here on staff or whether you're here as a guest, you go back down the lake, and when you get into 25 Mile Creek or into Chelan, you discover a whole different world. And I'm going to try and describe some of this to you so that you can get some feel for where people are who live in the situation where this theology was developed and worked out. Let's suppose you arrive down there and the first thing you discover is that you don't have a car anymore. Someone has taken your car. And so you go to the police station in Chelan. When you arrive at the police station, it's a sort of a broken down building in the center of town, the flagpole out in front, and the flag's not there. You go in to make a complaint, and there are three people working in that police station, and there are about 400 people milling around. No one seems to know what to do, and you certainly don't. You've never had your car stolen before. You don't know what to do. And so you start asking people, and people just tell you about their troubles, and they don't really understand your problem. Finally, you're able to make contact with one of the people who works in the police station. And he pulls out of his pocket a small scrap of paper on which he writes down some of the information that he thinks he might need, like what your license number is and what kind of a car it was and when it was stolen. And after you give him all that information, he tells you that they'll get in contact with you. And he hasn't written down your name or your address or anything like that, and so you insist that he write that down. He writes that down on the back of the little scrap of paper. And you notice as you're edging your way out of all of these people that he throws that scrap of paper over on a table where there's a great big mound of scraps of paper with all kinds of different information on them. You never hear anything more about your car. So you have to get back home, so you go into a bus station in Chelan, if there is a bus station there, and you try to make connections to get back to wherever it is you live. You find out, first of all, that the bus fares are very high, very expensive, that the bus fare to go to your town is more money than you have in your pocket. So you think maybe what you'll do is call somebody on the telephone, maybe a friend or a relative. You find there is a phone booth in the town, but that the phone is not in the booth. There's no phone, it's just an empty booth. And so you go around to different stores and you finally find a store that has a telephone, and the owner says, yes, you can use it if you make a collect call. And so you make you dial the zero and you wait and wait and wait and wait, and finally there's a connection and the operator asks you who you want to call, and you give her the number and the town, and there's a rattle of noises and somebody answers the phone who you don't know, and they say, oh no, this isn't such and such a town, this is another town altogether. And you go through this process maybe for an hour trying to call whatever person it is you want to call, and you're not ever able to make that kind of connection. Finally, you're able to get home somehow, maybe by hitching a ride with someone else you know or riding in the back of a cattle truck. When you get home, you find out that your father or mother or sister or brother, someone in your family, has been taken very ill. And that person is there at your home when you arrive. But when you decide that you have to take this person to a hospital, in the first place, you have no car to transport them in. In the second place, you don't have any money already, we established that, to hire a taxi or something like that. And so you take this person who is very, very ill to the nearest bus station, bus stop, which is the street corner wherever it is you live, and you flag a bus down. And when the bus comes, there are literally people hanging out of the front and back doors. And here you are with this sick person on your arm, and you decide that there's no way that you could possibly shove this sick person into the bus and get in there yourself. And so you see if you can get someone to help you. Perhaps a friend walks by on the street, and you help this sick relative to a hospital. When you get to the hospital, the first thing they ask for is a series of identification which you have left at home. In the second place, they say that if you had that identification, you would also need about $200 in cash in order to get that person into the hospital, which you also don't have. And even if you had that $200 in cash, there aren't any empty beds right now. And so you can't get that person into the hospital. And this happens all the time. You take the person back home, and the person gets sicker and dies. Or a neighbor's daughter coming out of school one afternoon is attacked by a group of young people, and her books are stolen. She doesn't have any money or anything like that. They steal her books, and there's a scuffle, and she's stabbed. She begins to bleed, and her friend is with her. She's about 15 years old. Her friend is with her, and her friend tries to help her, but there's not much she can do. And from time to time, a police cruiser goes by, but they won't stop. One finally does stop, but he refuses to take this girl to the hospital because he's going off duty. Another one stops, and finally the little friend happens to have 100 pesos in her pocket, about $2, and offers them to the policeman if he'll please take her friend to the hospital. After thinking it over for a while, he finally says he'll do it, takes the 100 pesos, and starts looking for a hospital. And they go from place to place, and by the time they finally find a hospital where they say this girl can be admitted, she is bled to death. These are the kind of daily events that occur in your life if you live in a Latin American country, unless you're one of the very, very few people who have access to places like good hospitals and good schools, the 10% of the people who have the great wealth in these countries. Telephones don't work. People aren't punctual about taking care of services. If you, for example, get your light bill at the beginning of the month and you go to the office of the light company to pay your bill, it means missing a whole day's work and standing in line. If you get your phone bill, it's the same thing. And if by chance you happen to get them, what more frequently happens is the person who is paid to deliver these bills simply throws them in the trash can and takes the money for delivering that day. You don't get your bill, and then your lights or your phone or whatever you might have is shut off. Once the electricity is shut off or the water is shut off, getting it turned back on again is a very lengthy and expensive process. It means spending several days standing in lines. It means paying great amounts of money to people under the table so that they will reconnect your services. If you try to make a complaint about any of these kinds of things, you can go to the police, or you can go to your local community action council and make a complaint. If you go to the local community action council and are fortunate enough to find someone sober there, they may make out a complaint form for you, and then your name is also put on a list. This is one of the troublemakers in our barrio. We want to keep an eye on this person. This is someone who will not simply accept the way of life that is ours. If you have money, however, you can pay that person. Your name doesn't go on the list, and a repairman or a person to reconnect your services will be at your door within a few days. A lot of young people growing up today in Latin America are seeing exactly what kind of a situation they have. They have an extremely corrupt government from the top on down. They have a militant police force and a national army which operates as a police force. And for example, a young person, a good friend of mine, a man who was my co-pastor for 2 years, was picked up routinely as he studied in night school, trying to get an education so that perhaps eventually he could go into the ministry or do some other kind of thing. And about every 5 or 6 months, these people are picked up by the police. And what happens, as Ramon tells me, is that you come out of school at night, and if there's a police van nearby or a truck nearby, they simply load all the students in. Everyone who's carrying books gets loaded into the van. Then when the van is full, they take it to the nearest police facility, or if those all happen to be full on that day, they take you to the bull ring or to the stadium, which are all open. They take all your clothing away from you except your underwear, and you spend the night sitting in an open patio area, and the weather in Bogota is just like this. And in the morning, you're given your things back. No explanation is ever made. You're never asked for your identification. You're never questioned. Nothing is ever said to you. You're simply released the next day. Should you make any complaint, however, while you're in that facility, then you are not released the next day. And you may be there for 2 days or a week or a month or until they get tired of having you around. These are the kinds of things that go on in the daily life of most people in Latin America. They simply don't know what might happen from one day to the other. You can't make long-range plans. And everywhere you turn, you run into all kinds of obstacles. If you're a parent and you want your young person to get an education so that they can advance themselves, according to our dream perhaps, and maybe it's the capitalist kind of dream, that the person who is who educates themselves and who is who works hard can then receive the benefits of those kinds of things. If you're one of those people, for example, a mother or father, and you have a child who you want to be educated, you could send them to the public schools. There are public schools. What happens in the public schools is it only costs about $1 a month to send a child to the public schools. But at entering a public school, the first thing you have to do is buy uniforms for your child. And that's not only the uniforms they wear to school, but they also have to have a physical education uniform. And that includes shoes, tennis shoes for physical education, regular shoes for other. And by the time you get into buying all the uniforms and the shoes and all these other things that cost the same that they do in the United States, you've paid perhaps $100 to $150 to enter your child in school. If you're a person who makes the average salary in many, many Latin American countries, and certainly in Colombia, about $90 a month, trying to come to gather together $100 or $150 for one child, let alone for three or four or five or six, is virtually impossible. If you're lucky enough to do that and get that money together, if you can borrow from friends and put it together so that you can get your child into that school, the child goes to school and 3 days out of five, the teachers don't show up. For one reason or another, because they're on strike that day, or because it's a national, or because there's a problem, a military or police problem that day, or because the teacher is sick, or whatever the excuse may be, the average child receives 2 days of instruction every week in all of the different materials they study. So that at the end of a year, there are national exams. And if the child doesn't pass the national exams, then they stay in that same grade for the next year, and you're back into the same situation. If the child is lucky enough, as very few are, to finish the six grades of primary school, 5 grades of primary school, and pass into a high school program, then the expenses go up. And the public high schools are absolutely full all of the time. Getting your child into a public high school means being able to pay enough money to some official so that you can get your child's name on the list. And so you have to, once again, look for perhaps $200 or $300 to pay off different people to get your child into the public school. If you can't get them into the public school, you try to put them in a private school, which are much better, generally speaking, than the public schools. And there the expenses are even higher, and the monthly fees to send a child to private schools run from $10 to $20. So if you're, as in the case of one woman who was a friend of ours and a member of our congregation, she was alone. Her husband had left her, as is quite frequently the case in Latin America. It's not too different from the black matriarchal culture we know about in the United States. Lots of women have to support their families altogether because the men, generally speaking, are rather irresponsible. She was a woman with four of whom were in school. And just the expense to get them from her house to the school and back every day ran her about $2 a day on bus fares. And her employment was, what do we call modestería? Sewing. She sewed clothing for others. And she earned from that employment about $3 to $4 a day. So half of her income then went for bus fare, much less the food. A hamburger is $1.50 a pound. Rice is, let me see, what would rice be? 55 cents a pound. Everything is very expensive. It's not cheaper to live in Latin America, but the salaries are much lower and the possibilities are much more limited. No matter where you try to do something, if you want to see the situation different in your community, if in your area of the city or the country where you live there are very unsanitary conditions, for example, right away you run into a government bureaucracy that is overloaded, that doesn't function. Most people die in Latin America. The highest cause of death, the leading cause of death, is amoebic dysentery, simply a health issue, bad water. Not only amoebic dysentery, but people die simply from diarrhea. That is about the third leading cause of death in Latin America. Most people don't grow old enough to be afflicted by cancer or heart disease. Most of them die much younger than that from intestinal disorders because of the poor sanitary conditions. If you're someone who wants to change that and sees that need, and you try to work either through the government or through your local community, you run into the same series of obstacles. In the first place, if you were the one that wants to organize something, wants to get something started, your name goes immediately on a list. This is a troublemaker. This is a person who's trying to upset things here. And you become an outcast among the people that live right around you because the word is passed to them and all kinds of things are said about you which aren't true. If you try not to organize, but you simply try to keep your home in a decent and healthful condition, sanitary condition, you find that doesn't work either because everyone else's dirt blows into your yard. The dirty water that comes down the pipe comes into your house as well. And you're up against all kinds of obstacles. Those are the kinds of conditions that the average, everyday, ordinary person lives in Latin America. It's not hard to see then why people have looked for some way out of this situation. Now with the evolving of television and mass communications, even in Latin America, people are able to turn on television sets all over the country and see a kind of life, a style of life, a way of doing things that's very different than theirs. They see people washing their hair with shampoos. They see people standing in showers, something almost unheard of. They see people in tiled bathrooms, or they see people with carpeted floors, or people with dishes on the table, and so on. And they have the same kinds of aspirations to have those things in their homes that you and I have. They feel frustrated. They feel confounded at what's going on in their society. And not too long ago, starting in the middle 60s and probably reaching its real peak in the late 60s in Latin America, a lot of people in the Roman Catholic Church particularly began to say, this is wrong. Something here is very, very, very sick. And it's not only our way of life, it's not only because of our own fallen nature, but something is wrong with our society. And they began to think about that and reflect about that, people living in those kinds of conditions, and lots of other people who were part of a more affluent kind of living in those countries, people like Camilo Torres, who was a priest in Colombia, who had grown up as one of the 26, member of one of the 26 families that rules that country. And he saw that the terrific disparity between what he had known and what everyone else was living in. And these people became very concerned about what was going on and began to say, does the gospel speak to this kind of a situation, the situation we live in? Does it have anything to say? And they had some backing. They had some push from even from the hierarchy in the church. Probably the first sign of hope was Vatican II, when in the conciliary documents, the largest document that came out of Vatican II was a document which talked about the church in the modern world and about the willingness of the church to hear the voice of God in the voice of the times. And later then, Paul VI, as Pope, most of us view him as a very conservative person. Most of us think of Paul VI as somebody who tried to put the brakes on the things that John the 23rd started. He wrote a number of encyclicals, especially Populorum Progreso, which was earth-shattering at that time, in which he said the issue really for Christians is Christian participation in struggles for social justice, and especially in actions favoring the powerless of the world. That's not a deviation from the main concern of the Christian faith, but it is precisely the relevant manifestation of it in today's world. There were other kinds of things that pushed people, that gave people help. Lots of people looked even to Luther's theology. And I think last week John was talking about the theology of the cross. When I read Lowenwinch, how do you say it? Is that it? The book, Walter...
Lowenwinch.
Walter Lowenwinch's book on Luther's theology of the cross, I found lots and lots of similarities between Luther's theology of the cross and liberation theology, especially the emphasis on God in the hidden, God in the opposite, that God is present in the oppressed of the world, in the downtrodden, in the marginal people. Dietrich Bonhoeffer picked up some of these same themes, and some of his work, which has been translated into Spanish, also has been a support for people who have thought in these ways. Then came the most important thing that happened in Latin America since the conquest, since the conquistadores, and that was the meeting in Medellin, in Colombia, in 1968, of the Latin American Bishops' Conference. And out of the Medellin Bishops' Conference, much to their surprise, even to many of the bishops, came a call for radical changes and the abandoning of privileged positions. The church in Latin America is part of the superstructure which has maintained the situation that I earlier described about people's lives. The church has simply not ever entered in, up until, say, the 1960s, not ever entered into the lives of the people in a radical and dramatic way, with very few exceptions. There were some priests, for example, Bartolomé de las Casas, and there was a man named Pedro Claver, who was a Spanish priest who came to Colombia in the early years after the conquest and worked against slavery, which was also prevalent in Latin America at that time. But aside from these very few instances, the Roman Catholic Church has been part of the superstructure, part of the organization which has continued the oppression of people. There were pastoral decisions then that came out of Medellin and this meeting of the Latin American Bishops' Conference, which had revolutionary implications. And they went like this. The decisions were to defend the rights of the oppressed. You can imagine what that might mean if you really took it seriously. To have a healthy critical sense of the social situation in which people live. To develop grassroots organizations, something that happened, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute. To urge a halt to the arms race. To seek just prices for raw materials coming out of Latin America. To denounce the unjust action of the world powers that works against the self-determination of weaker nations. And that's where you and I are involved, and perhaps it's the most difficult thing for us to talk about, but let's do that anyway. Just a few more comments, and then I'm going to give you some explanation of how this works out. The concern in liberation theology and beyond liberation theology, really, the concern of involved Christians in Latin America is to see the world in the light of the gospel through the eyes of the oppressed. Because the church and its hierarchy had always been part of the ruling class and part of the oppressive structure. Now the church was saying in lots of places, we want to see the world through the light of the gospel, by what the gospel says to us, through the eyes of the oppressed people. And it was a very different world they saw. And so this kind of theology begins with the poor and uses the social sciences for analysis and functions in what is called praxis. Now, maybe Marilyn can give us a better definition of praxis than I can, because I don't know too much about definition of terms. But I know that praxis means doing or action. And what theologians in this movement talk about when they talk about praxis is a sort of a figure eight laying on its side. And they talk about the movement between action and reflection, and that there must be this constant movement that there can't be reflection without action, and there can't be action without reflection, so that you get into a process which involves doing and thinking at the same time. Now, this is an interesting criticism of Latin American, by Latin American theologians, of the North European or the North Atlantic way of doing theology, which has always been to close ourselves in somewhere and to think and to reflect and to read commentaries and to study the Bible. They say that you can't do that, that real theology takes place out there, working with the poor, with the oppressed, with the chosen ones of God, and that then in that context, living with that family, living in that barrio where conditions are so terrible, there is where you do your theologizing. And the real teaching that takes place is not by the theologians, professional theologians, toward the people, but that the people are teaching us. And this is probably the central idea of liberation theology. It means doing theology in a different kind of way. It means being with people. One of the key words for us in Latin America is Emmanuel, God with us. And Emmanuel then means God with us and us with them. Being with is the important ingredient. In order to be able to do theology, you've got to be with people. Okay, praxis then is a process which seeks to transform society. Now, those are really dangerous words, you know, because we're not talking about transforming people's spiritual lives. We're not talking about transforming churches. We're talking about transforming society. It's a very dangerous concept. And transformation is, too. Some people in liberation theology use transformation as a code word. What they really mean is revolution. But they say transformation, because revolution isn't very acceptable in most circles. And it isn't simply a cerebral kind of activity, but it's action-oriented as well. The task then isn't, in the words of one theologian, the task isn't orthodoxy, which means right thinking, but orthopraxis, the right combination of thinking and action and doing. This way of thinking about the world and about thinking about our faith in the world and what it means to be a Christian in our situation centers in on liberation, people being liberated. For years and years, I preached about liberation too. But I preached about it in a very individual kind of way, or even in a community kind of way. When they say liberation, they mean a blend of three things. First of all, an escape from oppressive structures. You know, once again, very dangerous kind of thing, because you're talking now about politics, you're talking about sociology, you're talking about economics. First of all, an escape from oppressive structures. How can anybody be ministered to while you're standing on their foot? You know, if you're standing on my foot, the pain is so excruciating, I can't listen to what you're saying very well. If you get off my foot, it's a lot easier for me to dialogue with you. Escape from oppressive structures, then, is the first step. And then acknowledging history as an area of human responsibility. That is to say that in liberation theology, God is directing us, since he is the God of history, as I think we've had laid out very beautifully in these past few days, he is the God of history. And his concern is that we be, as God's people have always been, a historical people, and that we take responsibility for what's going on in history. As I wasn't able to be with Hans in Hans's meeting yesterday, but as I'm sure he mentioned, I think my wife communicated to me, the responsibility of the German people, of the German Christians during the time of the Holocaust. God is calling us not simply to an individualistic kind of relationship with him, but we have responsibility in the area of history. And the third thing involved in full liberation, first of all, escape from oppressive structures. Second of all, an acknowledgement of history as an area of human responsibility, and that means we're working with structures and political structures and economic structures and so on, is a recognition that personal sins are forgiven. There we get to ground that I think we're more familiar on. You know, we feel more comfortable talking about sins and forgiveness. And that is a part of liberation theology, too. They realize, I think, the really reflective people who are involved in this activity and who are involved with the poor don't idolize the poor or beautify the poor or become unrealistic about the poor, because I had a retreat just before we left Colombia in the first part of May. And I remember the high point of the retreat was we were talking about oppression and about that it's not just oppression, but that there's human sin involved here too. And I remember example I used, the national drink in Colombia, well, there are several. One of the big national drinks in Colombia is called chicha. It's a sort of a, what would we say, a rudimentary kind of alcohol made like we used to make corn whiskey in the United States, corn mash. It's a drink made by mashing corn together and putting sugar in and letting it ferment a little. And it's a very dangerous thing because just like bathtub gin was, I guess you can go blind from it and lots of people have died from it and so on, but everyone makes it. Anyway, that's sort of subsided. Now chicha isn't nearly as popular. They have cerveza, they have beer, which is much more popular now. So I was talking to the young people about how some people tend to kind of beautify the poor. And I said, like, I remember up in El Cocuy, a little mountain village where we have a church in. And these wonderful poor people, they're so beautiful and so holy and so sanctified. And these are the ones that need to be liberated. And they come down to do their market on Friday mornings. And they come down really early, about 5 o'clock from the mountainsides, so they can get their market done by 6 and start drinking. And by 7:30 or 8, they're pretty well bashed. And they're out killing one another with bullets or with fists or whatever it is, and just causing general havoc in the town. And the whole town just kind of closes up at 8 o'clock on Friday mornings because everyone is scared to death. And I said, now I know what you're going to say. Yes, but they're all being kept drunk by the great international oligarchy which runs the distilleries all over the world and the beer-making organizations, because like in Colombia, Bavaria is the biggest beer maker, and it's a German-related firm and all of this, and it's those foreign imperialists that are keeping our population drunk. And what about the chicha? Nobody imports chicha. People make chicha themselves. And they get drunk on it and do horrible things to one another. So a recognition that personal sins are forgiven is important. We can't think for a minute that poor people are somehow more holy than the rest of us. Okay, what about us? What if we can accept the fact that people are thinking and talking in these kinds of terms, what does it mean for us? One of the clearest writings in English and by a North American theologian on liberation theology is Robert McAfee Brown, who's written a real dandy little book that I would recommend to anybody who wants to know more about liberation theology and wants to do some reflection on what it says to North American Christians. He's written a book called Theology in a New Key. It's a relatively recent book. It's in the library here. This is the library's copy because I didn't bring mine along. I'll put this back this afternoon, and anybody that wants to look at it in the next few days can do so. He also has an excellent bibliography here where he gives you all of the authors that are writing in liberation theology today. He says that we are in what he calls ideological captivity. And this morning in Dave Bella's session, I couldn't help but think that ideological captivity that McAfee Brown talks about has a lot to do with this kind of technological mold in which we find ourselves. Makes us unable, really, to get ourselves into another thinking pattern and to understand how other people react and how other people analyze their own future, their own present. Essentially, says Brown, we have a series of defense mechanisms which we have constructed to protect us against reality. And when these are challenged, could there be another way of looking at things? Impossible. When these are challenged, we feel threatened. I know I feel threatened. And I felt threatened in Latin America, too, in the work that I did with Christians there, because there was also the what we call a North American evangelical mold, which had been implanted in Colombia and all of the other countries in Latin America, which provides for a nice, neat escape. You don't have to confront reality because you get right with God and everything will be fine by and by when you die, pie in the sky. And that kind of theology is very prevalent, and that kind of teaching is there. And that was the teaching that I found in the Lutheran Church when I arrived. And it's a very nice, insulated kind of thing. You can deal with people, they understand the language, and so on. But that's not where it's at. We feel threatened then because many of the things that liberation theology says are really accusations, direct or indirect, toward North Americans, specifically. And toward the developed world in general. Let me say just seven things that are as obnoxious as I can think of that liberation theology says, and then we can maybe enter into some dialogue, and I would like to give you some examples then of the working out of this theology that I have seen that maybe aren't as frightening, but first I'd like to make you all sick. some obnoxious conclusions of liberation theology. The first one, and the most obnoxious one to me, is that God has a preference for the poor. Can you buy that one? God prefers the poor. They are his favorites. Can you believe in a God that plays favorites? I have had a terrifically difficult time with that. And even the Roman Catholic Church in Medellin in 1968 and in Puebla, Mexico, 2 years ago, reiterated the same thing, that the preferential option of God and therefore of the church is for the poor. A God who takes sides, a God who plays favorites. Now, we had the example, one of the paradigms that's used for this is the Exodus story, because there God was on the side of the oppressed and he really crushed the other guys pretty good. And there are others in the New Testament like that. But the idea that God plays favorites is not acceptable, I don't think, for most of us in our way of thinking about him or her, it, God. Another obnoxious conclusion of liberation theology. An important biblical theme is justice, maybe even a central biblical theme. And it's impossible to have love without justice. Love without justice isn't love. And justice means caring for those in need. Not only the widows and the orphans, which are always mentioned in the New Testament, but the poor and the oppressed who are mentioned in the New and the Old Testament. One of the texts largely used to help us understand this is the final judgment that's spoken of in Matthew 25. And there are lots of interesting things about that final judgment. First of all, it's a judgment of nations. You know, am I going to be judged on the basis of what Carter or Nixon or Johnson or Reagan do? Judgment of nations. And the judgment is based on whether people have cared or have not cared for those in need. For this reason, then, say the liberationists, the gospel demands opposition to oppression. I have real trouble with that one. Lots of liberation theologians, and especially Juan Luis Segundo, who is one of the more articulate of the liberation theologians, talk about annunciation and denunciation. You've got to denounce and announce. We've been pretty good at announcing, in a general kind of way, announcing the gospel. But that announcement must go with a denunciation of oppressive forms and oppressive structures and things which are limiting people's options. A third obnoxious conclusion is that there are two easily identifiable oppressors in the modern world, and they are equally bad. They are called the USA and the USSR. They're both horrible. And they are at the helm of the oppression, the ship of oppression that's ruining the third world. Another obnoxious conclusion is that the institutional church in the Western world has completely sold out to capitalism and will protect it at all costs. That capitalism has become united with the Christian community in the developed world, and that the church will, whatever the cost, will defend capitalism. And maybe one of the most obnoxious conclusions of all, that capitalism is part of the oppressive force now experienced in our world and cannot change the status quo. It can't do it. And that maybe socialism can. And that's a very frightening thing for us, I think. The very idea that, in the first place, that capitalism can't change the situation. You know, developmentalism was the idea for the developing world, what we call the developing world, since 1950. The idea was that somehow we can get all of these other countries into the mainstream of development to rise to the same state of development as we have. Of course, I guess we didn't think too much at that time about what it cost in terms of resources to get this country to that point, that it involved more than half the world's resources. And so if only one country needed that much in order to get to this place, how could you possibly get all of the third world into that position? And that maybe socialism is the answer for Latin America, which was a situation of oppression, a situation of poverty. They can understand the scriptures better than we can. That their interpretation of the scriptures is much closer to what it should be than ours. You know, first you're telling me that my form of government is wrong, then you're telling me that I'm oppressing you, then you're telling me that the form of government which I almost oppose with everything in my being is wrong, and that my church is against you and hurting you, and now you tell me that I can't even understand the scriptures, or that the understanding that I've always had of the scriptures is wrong. And lastly, and this is where the rubber hits the road, I guess, or where we all feel either totally turned off or guilty, is the assertion by liberation theologians that everyone takes sides. There is no neutrality. Either we contribute to the liberation of the oppressed of the world, or we contribute to the exploitation of the oppressed of the world. One or the other. That there's no neutral ground. Now, I find all of that very threatening, and I'm not saying that just to be funny. I really do. And I've resisted the liberation kind of thinking in my ministry, and certainly in my ministry in Latin America. But as I lived more and more with people and dealt with them, I saw more and more the need to do something, and it had to be something radical and something immediate in order to truly minister to people in the situation in which they live. Maybe you've got some reactions before I go on and say some things about the specific working out of this theology that I've been involved in. Maybe you'd just like to make some comments. And it's okay to say, you know, I just think that's all terrible. That's all right. I think most of it's terrible, if not all of it.
But it may be accurate.
It may be accurate, yeah. Now, you situation ethicists, I know what this. One of the things I think I've learned in my very short ministry is to feel that things aren't nailed down, and that maybe all this is wrong too. One of the reasons I liked Douglas John Hall's book, Light in Our Darkness, where he talks about a theology of the cross for North America, which isn't too far from this either. One of the things I liked is he kept talking about distancing ourselves from that, from any given theological point of view. And saying, okay, that's interesting, but that could be all wrong. Something that most of us are not accustomed to doing. And so it could be all right, could be all wrong. Other comments or reactions or thoughts? How do you like being called the oppressor? Do you feel like an oppressor?
Don't you think it all has a political base, that certain people are trying to achieve a political end, and therefore they bring to theology their political, both aspirations and presuppositions, and sort of blend the two together. And that, you know, I'm sure that a liberation theologist may want to call somebody an oppressor, but it really, it's beside the point. The point is that's a tool to achieve an end, to mobilize power, to mobilize people, to sway opinion, to...
I think it gets to, you know, it gets to politics right away. There's no way to avoid it, because even at all the pressure points where people are being oppressed, one finds out immediately that the political answers are all negative. You know, no political answer is able to solve anything in the present situation, and that in order for Juanita to be liberated from this horrible situation in which she lives, it's going to require an entire change of structures. And so then you're talking politics. But as to that being the motivating force, I don't think so. I don't think that's where it begins. Yeah, Larry.
On that point, it might just be worthy of mention that the people who write liberation theology, by and large, have been priests, generally middle class and certainly educated, mm-hmm. who have done liberation theology, the reflection out of work with the poor. Yeah. And so it essentially grows out of the confrontation with
right.
the situation that you described early on, and then necessarily, as you said, moves to politics, because there isn't any, that's the handle by which you change structures. But it's not a simple rallying, a simple use of theology.
Yeah, I think
point of view arrived at from some other...
Right. I think you get radicalized, you know, to get right at your...
That's what happened to them.
You become radicalized, you know. When you take the simplest kind of thing and begin to work it through to its natural conclusion, you find these barriers everywhere. And you find that you're up against not a simple thing like maybe an official who won't listen to you, or a policeman who doesn't pay attention to the need, or a health official who won't do the job. You're up against an entire structure that has been put together deliberately or accidentally to fix all the water pipes and keep the north end of town clean where we live, and to hell with them. And it's put together that way deliberately or by accident, but that's where it's at. And so then you get radicalized, and you feel that in order to even begin to look at these things, you've got to meet the crisis where it is. Any other comments or reactions? Or yeah, Marilyn?
In reaction to what you said about Douglas John Hall and his kind of plea for an objectivity about our theologies, I think liberation theologians would say don't equate whatever you see as the needful changes in your society with the kingdom of God. So they don't say we have the answers, we know exactly what needs to be done. But they do say that we all delude ourselves if we don't realize how subjective we are in all our theologies, whether we're North Americans, South Americans, Europeans. And so they say there's no way to do theology realistically unless you first admit that you do live in a concrete historical situation, that that has to influence the way you look at the world and the way you read the gospel. Uh-huh. And to be honest about all the baggage you take to the gospel, try and tag it as much as you can and know what you have with you, but that none of us are really objective, and that they claim that they would like to push us to be a little more honest about our own subjectivity.
I remember very well that one of the great criticisms that we made as students at the seminary against the professors, and it was a generally heard criticism too on the part of people out in the parishes, was that those seminary professors lived off there on an ivory tower somewhere, and they didn't know what was going on in the real world. They didn't have parishes like you do, or like other people do. They didn't really gear in, and they got just totally separated, and then the idea came that maybe even they ought to go back out once in a while, and you know, you've probably heard about that kind of thinking. I think that liberation theologians get at that very, very directly, and they say precisely, one cannot do theology separated, and one has to be involved in the context. And then, as Marilyn says, once you're in that context, you realize that it's a contextualized theology. You're talking and thinking and reflecting on God's action in history, and on what he wants for his people right here and now in this particular barrio of this particular city at this particular moment. And maybe the frightening part of that is thinking that could have political implications, that maybe God wants me to rise up and, you know, be a leader, or he wants me to support some given group. Larry?
There's a nice little story that Robert McNeil Brown tells about going to the conference in Detroit in 1978, Theology of the Americas Conference, where a number of Latin American liberation theologians and feminist theologians, Black American theologians, and so on, met to talk about liberation theology. And Robert McNeil Brown said he was talking with the Latin Americans, and he kept referring to what he did as theology, and kept referring to what they did as Latin American theology. And one of them called that to his attention. Why do you call what we do Latin American theology and what you do theology? And his immediate intuitive response was, well, yours is from a particular point of view.
Yeah, mine's from God.
But we do that all the time. We don't ask how our economic, political, social, family factors all shape our thinking about God and others and self.
I think that's important.
They're just acutely aware of that impact, and they have some tools that they've developed to ferret out the influence, and they want to be very self-conscious about it. That's the practice, action, reflection.
Yeah. I don't think the liberationists would insist that we simply ingest their kind of thinking and theology at all, precisely because of what Larry's saying.
You
can't do it.
Contextual. You can't take their theology and apply it. Mm-hmm. That's the false notion, as if theology is universal and then is applied to situations.
Yeah. What we need to do, I think, is listen to what it's saying, and where it does touch us, you know, where it does involve us, then we need to do our own kind of reflection. Yeah. Like at the point of whether or not we are oppressors. And if we are, and whether the church has any part in this whole system. For example, I think the real struggle, the serious struggle which the American Lutheran Church has gone through and is going through, as to whether or not we should divest ourselves of interests in South Africa, through that we have money invested in various companies that do business there and so on. This entire struggle, I think, grows out of this kind of thinking, that perhaps we have a part in this whole system one way or another, and that's what we have to examine. And I think the fact that it's a painful kind of thing, and even, I believe, two members of the board that control our investments have resigned as a result of that decision, and I think that's okay. That they did that in conscience, but those kinds of struggles have to continue. Any other comments? And I'll give you a couple of ideas about what's happening as a working out of this kind of theology, but maybe you have something else that you're just dying to say, like shut up or something.
I have a little question. I think the emphasis that I get is on transformation of world.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I wonder how the liberation theology persons meet the question, which I think you're aiming at, and that is transformation of us. And I had the feeling that, at least that's always been my theological training has been telling me, that was the emphasis in the New Testament. Paul, Christ, were not interested in changing the social structures, but in changing persons, they were lighting the dynamite that changed the social structures. I have the feeling that your emphasis here is more to get us to think new thoughts, maybe to change our attitudes, and then whatever we do will be different. How do they meet the question, should not that be the emphasis?
Uh-huh. I think maybe, and Marilyn could maybe help out on this too, the emphasis in liberation theology is not personal conversion or personal transformation, which then transforms a society or a church, but structural transformation, which carries with it then the individual transformation. And yes, I have the same doubt in my mind, and I have always maintained that Jesus didn't teach that he taught very much a more personal kind of thing, and that if anybody lived in a time of oppression, he certainly did. The Roman oppression was... If there's oppression in the world today, it's nothing compared to that time, I think. But yes, the liberationists have said, the problem with that is that if you transform all of these poor people one by one, in the first place, the oppression continues while you're doing that, and lots of other people die and are cheated of their liberty and so on. In the second place, the structures will find ways to subvert that so that no real transformation ever takes place. So you've got to meet the issue where it is. The structures must be changed, and they must be changed radically and immediately. And yes, that gets into the issue of revolution, mm-hmm. and that's where I have some real questions, and I think probably it's the weak point of liberation theology, is that quite frequently it gets into a violent kind of posture, which I can't accept. I know lots of people who are working at liberation theology in a nonviolent way, and I'll give you a good example of a couple of them in a moment, and I think that's a real prime concern. When Adolfo Pérez Esquivel, you may have heard his name, he was on the cover of some magazine, Newsweek or something, not too long ago, won the Pulitzer Prize for Peace Prize in, Nobel Peace Prize, I'm sorry, in 1980, was the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. He's from Argentina. And he's been in and out of jail, and he's done a lot of other things. Well, anyway, our peace and nonviolent group in Colombia brought him there to do a presentation for us. And as we were working to arrange that, we went and talked with some of the alternate groups, many of them, most of them Christian, most of them Roman Catholic, in Bogota to find out what kinds of things we could do together. And we found out that people who are deep into liberation theology want to have nothing to do with the nonviolent movement. They feel that's one more North Atlantic pressure cop-out to keep things the way they are, to establish it, to maintain the status quo. I don't agree with that, but that tends to be the reaction. They say we're beyond the point of nonviolence, you know. And they say, well, you're a North American, it's 1776, for goodness sake. You know. Would you have eradicated nonviolence at that time, when British troops were in and occupying and burning cities and so on? Well, I don't want to get into that whole issue, but I have some real questions there. The whole issue of violence and how we can handle it. I want to give you, before we finish, a couple of examples of the working out of liberation theology, and then if there's some time, we can talk some more. First, a little teeny community way up in the hills in a place called Tolima, a little town called Palo Cabildo in Colombia. A priest, a man of about 45 years of age, born in a little village about 10 kilometers away from where he now ministers, educated right there in Colombia, went back and took this little parish, and he's been there 7 years. When he first got into the parish, and of course the Catholic parish is everybody virtually, you know, 5% maybe are some other wild sect, but most people are Roman Catholic. So he had a parish of about 20,000 people, if you count all the people in all the surrounding veredas, the mountain sides. He saw that, first of all, the Roman Catholic Church has an enormous problem of massification. One priest, 20,000 people. Second of all, people were not receiving ministry. And so he began to introduce and form little groups, what is now the most exciting thing going on in the church in Latin America. They're called Comunidades Eclesiales de Base, CEBs, Ecclesiastical Based Communities. And the idea is within the parish to form small cell groups that maybe aren't so small by our standards, 30 to 40 to 50 people. And that within these groups then, the people live out their Christian lives. And they also attend the mass of the entire community once a week on a Saturday or a Sunday. But during the week, and some of them who live way away can't come to mass every week. And so they celebrate the Eucharist in their little communities when the priest goes around. These little communities then organized in order to study the scriptures. Can you imagine? Study the scriptures. To pray together. To celebrate together. And they start with baptism and work through the entire Christian experience. Baptism, confirmation, marriage, etc., etc. And they really go at the scriptures in a very deep and careful way. He has trained leaders to all of these little groups. Okay, one day 2 years ago, the city council of this little burg says, we're going to raise property taxes. What they were really after were about 400 little farms dotted around on the hillsides around this little town. And they knew that if they increased taxes 450%, that most of these people would be squeezed out and that property would be theirs. And so they voted, or they were having a meeting to raise taxes. The priest got word of this, and some of the people in his parish reported it to him. The word went out then immediately to the meetings of the individual base communities, and they all decided that what they had to do was make their protest heard, that this couldn't be done, that they wouldn't allow this to happen. And so they organized, using nonviolent principles, a great big manifestation where they planned to have as many as 500 or 600 people start in this little town and march down to what we might call the county seat in the next little town 10 kilometers away on a Saturday afternoon and have a protest against this action of the city council. So they organized it, and lo and behold, it wasn't 500 people that turned out, but it was 2,500 people. And they did march down to this other little town, and they had everything well organized to resist provocateurs who were involved in the march and all the rest. They went to the little town, they had their meeting, they made their statement, and the city council then, out of fear of what might happen if they went ahead and passed that resolution to raise the property taxes 450%, did not vote. They tabled the motion. And now, a year and a half later, still they have not raised the property taxes in those little areas. That's one example of a working out of liberation theology. Another example is a congregation, a Lutheran congregation where there's a Roman Catholic church right next door, the congregation that I serve. In Bogota 2.5 years ago, there were terrific floods. We had a very heavy rainy season, and the little rivers that are used really just to drain the savanna, the big plain that we live on, all overflowed. And of course, where they overflowed was where the poor people live, because rich people aren't stupid enough to, nor do they go down and camp in that property down by the river. So lots of people were flooded out of their homes. And the priest in the neighboring parish, the parish in front of the Lutheran church then, not only opened the church and had about 250 people camping out in the sanctuary during a two-week period, but he put up a sign on the window. And the sign said this: "This community will not celebrate any sacrament until justice has been done for our brothers and sisters who live in poverty, for these people who are inside our walls." And so the priest refused to celebrate the sacrament until reconciliation was brought about for these people who were within his parish. Well, can you imagine the pressure? The bishop just flew out of his gourd when he heard that this priest wasn't going to celebrate the sacrament. Half the parish was up in arms. How can this possibly be? They were mad enough that all these people were cooking spaghetti and rice in the middle of the sanctuary. That was bad enough. Can you imagine what it does to the carpeting? But it was worse yet that he refused to celebrate the sacrament. And there was all kinds of activity and a flurry of things. Well, housing was obtained for these people. And they were moved out of the sanctuary. And 2 weeks later, the priest was moved out of his parish. Mm-hmm. He's now doing some confirmation ministry somewhere in a little town in the middle of nowhere. But those are workings out of liberation theology. And I think you can see what happens if you get involved in those kinds of things time after time. You can see why lists are made and why even bishops are killed sometimes. Because it goes against all of the defense mechanisms that people have built up to maintain things the way they are. And it's a very, very frightening kind of thing for most people to see happening. And that's why there's such a terrific reaction to it. Sometimes these things are what we might call innocuous or very peaceful in their origin and in their working out. But they become a real threat to established and entrenched governments which are busily oppressing all the people that they represent. You were going to say something before.
Let's see. I just wanted to come off a point that tie in with that.
All right. Any other comment or thought? You're free to leave, any of you that want to go to first lunch, first dinner. See you, Harvey.
Could we ask you about your own experiences? Did you find yourself, you said your vision has changed, did your ministry change, did you...
Sure did. I tried to stay out of trouble as much as I could. Foreigners in Colombia, and particularly North Americans, are not very well looked upon these days. But I'm sure I was on a list too, yes. And a lot of the work we did toward the end, with young people particularly, was work where nobody... In the old days, we used to get everybody's name and address and talk back and forth and share resources, and we found out we couldn't do that because it might get into the wrong hands. There were some people who would come and speak to us, but we couldn't use their real names. So there were lots of changes that took place in my ministry particularly. Also, I think a real emphasis as these young people became more and more aware of their situation, and consciousness raising is a part of that. That's a lot of that comes from Paulo Freire, a Brazilian who wrote a book called Pedagogy of the Oppressed and lots of other revolutionary stuff. But that's the beginning of that idea, that people, once they become aware of their situation, begin to do something about it. And that happened to us, I think. It happened in our youth group, that's for sure. In the old days, it was sing a few songs and clap your hands and pray, and that was fine. And we still were singing songs and clapping our hands and praying, but the songs and the prayers and everything had a different tone to them. And these young people were now convinced that they had to be a part of what was going to happen in their country, what is happening in their country. On Friday, I think it is, I'll talk a little bit more about the kind of explosive revolution that we're going to see all over Latin America. We've only seen the tip of the iceberg so far. It's going to be much worse and much more quickly than we might expect. But they want to be a part of that because that's where people are. People are suffering and dying, and they want to be with them in that. And so that has changed. Yeah. The ministry has changed, and even the church has changed. The president of our church, a very nice guy, a good friend of mine down there, an older guy, about 60, was reading Dom Elder Camara when I left. And we had a pastor's meeting, and they had a sociologist come in. Sociology faculties have all been shut down in all the universities because it's too revolutionary. They had a sociologist come in and talk about Marxism to the pastors. So it's different, you bet. There's a real consciousness raising going on. People are beginning to see what's happening.
Have you anything to advise us in how we can understand the situation better and have awareness building here in the States?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of real easy things that we can do. One is we can read. And I was going to suggest, too, for anybody who wants to read a Latin American who wrote this in English on liberation theology, there isn't anybody better than Bonino, because he's got, I think, a good detached kind of view, although he, too, is a theologian of liberation. But he's a Protestant, accidentally. The book is titled Doing Theology in a Revolutionary Situation by José Miguel Bonino. Works in Argentina at a seminary there. Teaches at a seminary which we are involved in as Lutherans, too. We can read, and there's also a bibliography here, or in the book by Robert McAfee Brown, good bibliography. There's lots to read. There's a outfit in New York called the New York Circus, which is way too revolutionary for me, but maybe you can handle it. I still enjoy reading some of the things they publish. They publish a little magazine called Lucha, which means struggle. I think it comes out bimonthly, in which they say all kinds of horribly radical things, but there are some real positive, substantive things there. There's a book called Cry of the People by a woman named Penny Lernoux, L-E-R-N-O-U-X, a lady who lived in Colombia and then lived in other parts of Latin America. She talks about the persecution of the Roman Catholic Church by the various rightist military dictatorships in Latin America over the past 15 years. The list of murdered people is growing. And if you heard about the murder of Oscar Romero in El Salvador 2 years ago now, that's nothing. The list now includes evangelicals, includes missionaries, includes native evangelicals, includes lay people. All kinds of people are being murdered to try and keep the lid on. And she talks about that. So reading is one thing we can do to find out. Another thing we can do is talk to people from Latin America. And some of you live in areas where there are lots of people from Latin America, and I think now in almost every part of the country there are some folks who have lived in Latin America. You can talk with them, and if they don't come out of the light-skinned bourgeois of Latin America, you may get a real different picture of what's going on there than you may have guessed before. I think one of the things I plan to work on is doing some exchanging and having some Latin American missionaries come up here to talk to us. Trouble is that not too many people down there speak English, but there are resources, and I think it would be real helpful to move in that direction, to hear some of these voices in person. There are lots of people like Emilio Castro or like Orlando Costas, who works for the World Council of Churches, who speak very good English and, in fact, say very frightening things, too, who are evangelicals even, not necessarily Roman Catholics, but evangelicals, some of them even Lutheran, who can help to raise our consciousness and help us to see what part we may or may not have. And then I think we have to pick up the black book and start reading again and think in terms of that person who lives in that horrible situation where there's no way out, and how do they read it when Jesus picks up the manuscript in the temple in Luke as he begins his ministry and starts out saying, you know, that God has promised freedom from oppression and sight to the blind. Do you think they read that in a spiritualized way? Or do you think they read that in a way that cop down the street who shot my son's friend the other day because he was drunk, that's one of the oppressors? You know, I think maybe they think more along those lines. And to try and understand what the scriptures say as a person might understand them from a very different frame of reference than we have. It's just impossible. I remember I was telling, I think it was Dan, that I remember when Bethel Bible Series first came out, a long time ago, I guess it was maybe 15 or 20 years ago, and Harley Swigum, who was the kind of the originator of that, was teaching at Central Lutheran in Minneapolis at that time, and I went to the first meeting there when he was going to introduce it, and I remember he got the whole group chanting, "Think like a Hebrew, think like a Hebrew." And that's what I heard Dan Erlander saying, think like a Hebrew to be able to understand what was going on. That's what I've heard Dave Bella saying, try to realize what it is that determines our thinking so that we can see that other people think in a very different way. Latin Americans don't think and operate in a way. And when he was talking about time on Monday or Tuesday, oh boy, did I gear into that, you know. When we used to start our worship services when I was pastor in San Lucas in Bogota, that was, you know, I play the guitar, so what I'd do is we had big song sheets and stuff. We had all kinds of good songs. And we just sing songs and just we just go on and on and on until I felt everybody was there. And you kind of knew when everybody was there. And when everybody was there, then we started. You know, there was no, we said, you know, worship 10:30. Mary used to say, well, another one of those 3-hour services. Well, we waited an hour for everybody to come, you know. And so we'd do exercises. We'd stand up and walk around, and the kids would go to Sunday school, and we'd sing songs. But finally, when it looked like everybody was pretty much there, we'd start. And inevitably, somebody, and Meredith's here to testify, inevitably, somebody would come in at the benediction. Right at the very end, I'd see them come in the door, and I'm standing up there, you know, in the name of the Father. And I'd see someone come in and stand at the door, and when I got out to the door, they'd say, oh, Pastor, how are you this morning? Oh, it's wonderful to be here, you know. they just arrived. And, you know, there was a pastor, a missionary pastor there, who was so uptight about this that he used to explode at his congregation, at the people, and even at another pastor. You know, when I say 11 o'clock, we start at 11 o'clock! You know, and he got into terrific arguments with people. And, you know, people come in late to funerals. I had people come out to the cemetery. We already put the vault up in the mausoleum, and the guys, the garbage men, were all done bricking it over, and the guy would come in and say, oh, you already got it bricked over. Oh, okay, you know. He arrived. It didn't matter that time isn't that way. I remember starting a funeral at 4 o'clock. I was the only one there. The body wasn't even there, you know. The dead person had not arrived. I said to the lady who was there, the lady was sweeping the floor in a church. I said, it's 4 o'clock. I said, where's the dead person? She said, well, they were doing the watch in the house, and they're not done yet, you know, and when they get here, they'll get here. Well, they got there at 4:45. And so I just sat there and twiddled my thumbs, you know. So there are all kinds of things that we simply can't get into. And I think to think like an oppressed person or to think like a dirt poor person who is up against, you know, a dirt poor person in this country and a dirt poor person down there are two different things. Because if you're dirt poor here and you get some kind of options like maybe getting your kid into school or maybe having that kid go to a university or whatever, there are no such options there. And so it's a whole different situation. And to try and understand that is virtually impossible, but we can do some things. I had even thought about when I was talking with Harvey, it was somebody else, about, he says, you know, I hope you contextualize it. Well, I'm going to try. He said, I've even thought of locking the doors, you know, and saying, well, now, John Schramm says that we're not going to be allowed to have dinner tonight. We're not going to be allowed to go to bed tonight. We all have to stay right in this room for the next 48 hours and and see if we could get some sense of the feeling that people have, you know. What do you mean? Outrage. We would be outraged. We even did a forced fast at a retreat with young people, and they were just absolutely outraged, you know. We all filed in for breakfast, and we said our prayer, and one of the young people stood up and said, I'm sorry to inform you this morning that there's no breakfast. It's just water on the tables. That's it. And they said, what do you mean? They said, we're going to fast today. That isn't what fasting is! You know? And so later on, we worked it out. There are a lot of people that come into the kitchen in the morning, and the mother says, I'm sorry to inform you, but today there will be no breakfast. And it's not by choice. It's not because of a religious decision. Were you going to say that?
I think what you're saying right now relates to that question earlier of whether love and justice are hand in hand and inseparable. Mm-hmm. I think we really need to look at that. And also the yes-no, to say yes to Christ.
Yeah, that's a good way of
putting
it.
Doesn't the yes to Christ say also yes to the quality of life and compassion? And doesn't that say no to just an awful lot that's in our world?
Yeah.
That's got to change if we're Christians in it and live out our life in it. And doesn't that also lead us into saying, if necessary, to die to try to bring that about? Mm-hmm. Maybe in a nonviolent way, but still to stand
to
say
life.
Yes and no in such a way that it's terribly clear.
We felt that way about Oscar Romero. You know, when Oscar Romero was murdered, we were just stunned. Everybody, even kids who weren't Christian. And I happened to be in our school. We have a big school in a small town. I happened to be there that day when the word came that he'd been murdered. And One of the kids, I didn't have to say it, one of the kids stood up and he said, you were talking yesterday, and I was too, it was coincidental, he said, you were talking yesterday about what it might mean, that it might mean giving your life. He said, that man gave his life. Yeah. And I guess that's one of the things where I've always had a lot of trouble, even up to the to this present moment. I can feel good about announcing the gospel. I don't feel so good about denouncing. But maybe you if you say yes, maybe there have to be some no's. They have to be spoken loudly, openly. It's a frightening prospect.
Uh-huh. Is it pretty obvious to you that El Salvador is probably the most hot spot?
No, in fact, I think that's the coolest spot right now.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Why?
Well, the armed conflict is taking a little bit of the pressure off. There are other places where the armed conflict hasn't broken out yet. It's much more tense. Mm-hmm. Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina, Brazil. Brazil's a terrible place to live today because it has all of the outward appearance of this country, for example. Mm-hmm. But the oppression is just overwhelming there, just overwhelming.
Would it be of any help for us to try to understand the political philosophy of Marxism that kind of is underlying that, isn't it, down there?
Yeah.
Really understanding it rather than having myths about it with comparing to our time.
Yeah. I think there's no question but that the liberationists use the Marxist analysis about class struggle and all that. I didn't say that before because I didn't want to be the one who brought it up. Now it's your fault, Chuck. They use the Marxist analysis. There's no question about that. I have some personal reactions against what I would call my understanding of Marxism. But I think you're right. Most of us don't really know what Marxism is all about. His analysis of what has happened down through history in terms of the people who own the means of production and the people who are the instruments of production is very helpful, and it's very much used. But the liberationists will adamantly insist that they're not going to be led astray by Marx either, because after all, he was a European. But that his analysis affords us some tools, just as Freudian analysis affords us a real opportunity to understand some things. Whether you like Freud or not, there's no question but that he's helped us to understand a lot of things that we didn't understand before, and that Marx plays that same role. My issue with Marxism and in some respect with liberation theology is the issue that Douglas John Hall raises when he says that it's still a man-centered way out, and the idea that the future is going to be great, you know, whether it's a fundamentalist idea that somehow God is going to make everything all happy and snoozy and wonderful out there in the future, or whether it's Marxism, which says that man, because of his innate goodness and all, we as Lutherans know that, and other Christians know that man doesn't have any innate goodness, but he has a tainted goodness now, that we have a fallen nature, that human person is no longer, you know, so that Marxism talks about some great utopic future in which human beings are able to work their new salvation out, and everything's going to be fine. That's another part of the illusion. It's just not so. It's not so. And another author who's helped me to understand a lot of things about all of this, and even helped me to understand Marxism better, is Ernest Becker. Some of you, I'm sure, have read Ernest Becker's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Denial of Death. He's written extensively. He's written lots of other books, all of which are in the library here, too. But that book and Escape from Evil, a later book that was published after his death posthumously, were the two books that helped me most to understand the real nature of man, because he doesn't come at it from a Christian standpoint at all. He comes at it as a scientist, anthropologist, sociologist, psychologist, and he simply lays it out. There is no future for man, for human beings. There is no future. That everything is, you know, and when John Douglas Hall talks about the downward spiral, you know, we're on it. And the idea that somehow some new class is going to emerge and people will suddenly come out into the light is a big, great big joke.